It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. He deals with death on a daily basis, and the number of interactions with the dead have been increasing in recent years because of the ongoing opioid crisis. Dr. Carl Williams is the medical examiner for Allegheny County. Dr. Williams, welcome to The Confluence.
It's very nice to be here.
Why does someone want to surround himself with death all the time?
Very good question. First of all, it's extraordinarily interesting at all times. Every instance of death provides new mysteries, new learning experiences, more knowledge about what's going on in our society.
Mm-hmm. Does it remind your colleagues of their own mortality?
I don't think we ever really think of that too much, to tell you the truth. It's just another fascinating job that we do. There's never been any discussion in my office of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Is it an avoidance, do you think, or it just doesn't come to mind?
I think everybody goes into the field because it's a fascinating field, because they know that they're fulfilling a function, and people are drawn into it for different reasons, but I don't find anybody drawn into it for really morbid reasons or reasons that are mm-hmm. personal in the sense of what you're right. talking about.
You used a couple of words in those first couple of answers. One was fascinating. Right. We hope all of our jobs, we hope, have a fascinating element to them. Fascinating, and you used the term mystery. So you're dealing with human life, the end of that life, actually. So how much do you look at the process as possibly solving a mystery, and how much does that come into play?
Oh, well, they're all mysteries to be solved. Some of them are very straightforward. So these days with the drug overdoses, the mystery is what the specific drug is, what the pattern is, what that means. But we know what the cause and manner of death is. And that's our prime responsibility, to generate a death certificate as to the cause and the manner of death. Sometimes they're complex cases that require an enormous amount of investigation, association with police, association with public services, right. reaching out to other sources. But they're all mysteries, and some straightforward mysteries, some very, very complex.
It's a workplace. It's also one reliant so much on science and sobriety, but also hopefully you might have, you know, it is a workplace. Do you enjoy your work? Do your colleagues enjoy your work? Are there any lighter moments, or is it so you're so wrapped into the science and solving these mysteries?
No, you have to maintain some sense of humor and perspective, or you wouldn't be able to function on a daily basis. So there's a certain amount of gallows humor, if you will, but we don't focus on that. The prime thing is very serious investigation into each individual case, and trying to not be morbid about it. So,
you've been a forensic scientist. You've been in this business for how long?
40 years now.
Okay, so you've seen, you know, how many people are coming new to the business, new to the profession. I have to ask you, you know, all those TV shows, CSI, NCIS, that involve some sort of forensic science involved in solving the crime, solving the mystery. What have they done? Have they boosted an increase in interest in the field, in your profession?
Oh, they definitely have. They've had consequences to people coming into the field, as well as consequences to what even a jury, for example, expects forensic scientists to say. I've got to say that all of those shows are virtually absent of any real forensic science. They're very entertaining shows, but virtually devoid of any real science in it, which is all right, too.
Right.
It's been more than 20 years when I was a pathologist at a community hospital that I was approached by a then high school senior who said she wanted to become a forensic pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
Long, hard row. She wound up instead becoming a forensic scientist working for the Pennsylvania State Police. More recently, I followed up finally
and
on
this. So she is in the profession?
Oh, yes, she is. So mm-hmm. so you can be a scientist trained in some discipline, and my operation has all of those science sections. So we see the toxicology. We see the drug overdose material that comes in. We do fingerprints. We do DNA. We have all of those, and you can become an expert in any one of those with just a bachelor's degree and then being trained.
And you were about to give another example, I think.
Well, just recently, and I was delayed a little by vacation, I followed up on a series of very, very intelligent, well-phrased letters of a young woman that said she wanted to come down and see an autopsy and visit the operation. And when I finally contacted her, she said, well, I can't start right away because I'm going into ninth grade. It's like, really?
Ninth grade,
yeah, local high school. And she's obviously is very intelligent. Her parents are fully supportive of this. She could wind up as a forensic pathologist, but you're talking about 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, and at least another year after that. It's not easy to get there, but it is the top of the heap when you get there. So it's a nice position to be in.
Well, let's hope that in 4, 8, 12, 13 years, she contacts you and say, I made it. I want a job.
I hope she comes and works for me. So.
So you, as I said at the beginning, are a medical examiner, but most counties in Pennsylvania have coroners, and usually they're, I guess, elected position. Can you briefly explain the difference, medical examiner versus coroner?
Sure. This is the fundamental distinction that goes all the way back to the beginning of the country. Coroners is a British system. The coroner is the agent of the crown, and that was the first systems that came into the United States. Now, across the United States, it's completely chaotic. Some states have a full statewide medical examiner. Others are mixed states, as is Pennsylvania. So there are 64, 65 counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, two official legal medical examiner system, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Allegheny County. The rest are all elected. It's starting to change a little. So some call themselves medical examiners, especially outside Philadelphia. I think there are only one actual forensic pathologist. Most of them are elected. Virtually all of them in Pennsylvania are funeral directors.
Yes.
Now, our responsibility is the same. Our responsibility is to determine cause and manner of death and sign the death certificate in all unnatural cases. So we function the same. I'm a member of the Pennsylvania Coroners Association. We have very common overlapping issues in terms of disasters and training. So we're doing the same job, but you need to be a board-certified forensic pathologist to be a medical examiner. That brings a different training, a different mindset to the job.
Okay. You work in Allegheny County, and you have the benefit of a major lab. So how does that help beyond just maybe the speed of solving the mystery?
Well, more than the speed, it's the ability to access information right away. And you're right. Every piece of evidence from the scene of a crime in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County comes in the back doors of the medical examiner's office, where we have sections in drug chemistry to look at all of the little stamp bags, toxicology to analyze the results, fingerprints, DNA, tool marks, all are upstairs. So Wednesday, in preparation for this show, all I had to do was go up and talk to my drug chemist, who is an acknowledged expert in the cannabinoids, which are the new forefront of drugs that you're hearing about all the time. Go next door to the toxicologist, who knows everything there is to know about the effect of those drugs on a person. Talk to my friend who's in the ER at Pitt. And in an hour and a half, I can know as much about what's going on as virtually anybody in the Commonwealth, all in-house, all with my experts who are extraordinary.
So that information is available really across Pennsylvania?
Well, Pennsylvania is dealing with the same crises. We've talked about overdose-free PA. So in that site, which anybody can go to online, for the counties that send in their drug reports, You can find out what drugs are going on and things.
Yeah. But there's no nationwide database that can share information?
No, there is no. Well, again, remember, and this is in 2009, the National Academy of Sciences issued a report called the Forensic Sciences. If you Google NAS 2009, they showed how chaotic the delivery of forensic sciences is and how underfunded it is across the entire country. You got 50 states. Each state is different. Within each state, each jurisdiction is different. There are no rules on how to define that you've got a drug overdose. There are no rules about necessarily how you report it. It varies everywhere. It's a horrible situation.
We have just 2 minutes left. Tragically, the cause of death in many, many of the cases in recent years read something like, quote, combined drug poisoning of cocaine, fentanyl, and heroin, or mixed drug intoxication of fentanyl and tramadol, or other variations. Quickly, is fentanyl the major culprit right now, or a major culprit?
So the crisis changes from year to year. Right now, in the opioids that stimulate the opioid receptor, fentanyl's the crisis. Fentanyl has bypassed heroin as the drug most commonly found in the mixtures that kill people, and they're virtually all mixtures.
So, So is there another killer out there that you're keeping an eye on, that you're worried about as far as a drug that could cause more fatal overdoses?
Personally, now we're still mostly worried about fentanyl and the opioids. There's been a major discussion about the cannabinoids, okay? We have very little solid information on how they're used, how they're getting in various places, how they're being distributed, what the toxic effects are. And actually, if you'll remember, we went through that with fentanyl a year ago, with the possible exposure to first responders and things. So it's a continually shifting field of what the problems are. Right now, I think we're going to continue with the opioids as the major killer.
Right. Just 30 seconds. I believe last year there were 737 fatal overdoses in Allegheny County alone. Health Department Director Karen Hacker said the deaths were up in 17 overall, but she thought she saw at least a little dip toward the end of the year. Is there any promising information that it might be turning downward a little bit?
Could be. Could be. The number of opioid overdoses actually peaked in the last quarter of 2016. But it's still a very fluid position of where we're going. And I'm not going to make any predictions so far, although it does look like it may have decreased, even though we don't really know why.
Dr. Carl Williams is the medical examiner of Allegheny County. Carl Williams, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It was good to be here.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, the Steelers open their season Sunday on the road against the Browns. David Green, NPR's most avid Pittsburgh sports fan, will talk about his personal Cleveland nightmare. A year ago today, the credit reporting agency Equifax announced a massive data breach that affected 147 million people. So whatever happened to all that stolen data? And WESA's Lucy Perkins brings you the last in her four-part series on abortion. All that and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. All state prisons are on lockdown after dozens of staffers across the state were sickened. Officials believe it's from exposure to a drug called K2. So what is it? A synthetic cannabinoid that can be sprayed onto paper, then smoked or eaten to produce a high. Look for more on that later this hour. And a new video game developed by CMU is helping children understand their peers who have autism. Set in a 3D forest, Prism uses animal characters to explore the challenges that children with autism face. Get more top news by signing up for our daily newsletter at wesa.fm/inboxedition.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together, or in this case, the sports come together. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's time for one of our occasional visits with NPR's most dedicated Pittsburgh sports fan, David Green. Hi, David.
Hey, Kevin. It's football season.
It's
time.
You're ready? It sounds like you're geared up.
I'm really geared up.
Okay, so 13-3 last year, the Steelers in the regular season. They were kind of squishy against some teams they should have beaten worse than they actually did. So I'm not sure.
No, and their defense, I need to be convinced that they have solved some of those problems. And the only thing that gives me hope is this feels like a different offense now. And maybe an offense that's going to be a little more efficient and focused on power and a little less splashy. And I think that the Steelers' defense always responds to more of a power offense. And I just hope it's going in that direction.
First game, Cleveland. They've improved. You have to admit that. So are you worried about game one or not?
Not only worried, I had a nightmare last night. I'm not kidding. The nightmare was pick six on Ben's first play from scrimmage, and then a fumble on the ensuing kickoff, and the Browns go right in, and they're up 14-0, like 3 minutes into the game, and the dog pound is going crazy. I swear to God. So, yes, I'm actually a little worried, and I know fellow Steelers fans are going to be sitting there thinking it's the Browns. But, yeah, I just need to see them on the field. I need to see them win decisively, and then we can move on with the season. Let's get that first game behind us.
Are you saying Cleveland is a nightmare? Or am I putting words in your mouth?
I don't want the entire city of Cleveland to be mad at me. No. Cleveland's a wonderful place with a football team that has just gone through some hard times. And everything points to us having no problem in that game. But what about Le'Veon? Like, is he come in rusty like last year and make us more vulnerable early?
He was rusty the first two, three games of last year. I think this, something similar will happen, but I really think he'll be great this year because it's big-time contract year. This is it for the Steelers, almost definitely. So he wants that super big contract on the free agent market.
It sounds like they were so close, doesn't it? I mean, I really thought they were it seems so close. I didn't think we'd be here.
Well, the Steelers put out those numbers purposely. They wanted people to know, the fans to know, you know, we're trying to do this.
So do you think, I mean, to what extent do they test out James Conner this year to see if he can be the future as they're pondering what to do with Bill?
Well, Ben Roethlisberger has said that he says that Conner has earned more carries throughout the season no matter what. He is in great shape. James Conner is in great shape. And they're all impressed with some of the how he's tried to overcome some of his weaknesses, including pass blocking. So he's getting high marks all around for that. So,
what a great story.
Yeah. The guy is just amazing, coming back from an injury, coming back from another injury, and, of course, coming back from cancer. You have to root for that guy.
Yeah, you really do.
So, David, all the great sports prognosticators, they offer a prediction. So that includes you. What's it going to be for the Steelers this year?
I think we're going to go through some heartache. I think they're going to go 10-6. They're going to sneak into the playoffs, and they're going to win the Super Bowl.
That's proud, terrible, towel-waving host of Morning Edition, David Green. Thanks so much, David.
You got it, Kevin.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If Judge Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed to the Supreme Court, he would create a conservative majority that could eventually overturn Roe v. Wade. Such a ruling could severely limit access to reproductive health care for women across the country. But as 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports, the landscape for abortion access has already changed since that 1973 Roe decision, thanks mostly to a Supreme Court case that started in Pennsylvania.
The 1992 case is Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
So Planned Parenthood versus Casey is the case that every law student in the country reads.
Sue Fritchie is a senior staff attorney at the Women's Law Project in Pittsburgh.
It established the constitutional standard by which abortion restrictions are measured.
Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania sued then-Governor Bob Casey Sr. over the Abortion Control Act. The law mandated a 24-hour waiting period and parental consent for minors. It also required women to notify their husbands before getting an abortion. Planned Parenthood thought the law violated Roe v. Wade.
The 1988 and 1989 Abortion Control Acts were a set of regulations that were designed specifically to get to the Supreme Court so that Pennsylvania would be the state that resulted in the overruling of Roe.
It was a roller coaster.
Stephanie Dangle is the executive director of the Innovation Practice Institute at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. She was also a Supreme Court law clerk when Planned Parenthood versus Casey was argued. Everyone thought this would be the case that would ban abortion, including Dangle. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who Judge Kavanaugh is set to replace, was the swing vote. Justices who wanted to overturn Roe lobbied him heavily.
we were on pins and needles worrying that that switch was going to happen up till the day that it was released.
Planned Parenthood of Southeast Pennsylvania versus Casey in a companion case.
This tape of the Supreme Court announcing the Casey decision comes from Oyez.org. The court upheld Roe with a caveat called the undue burden standard.
We reaffirm the constitutionally protected liberty of the woman to decide to have an abortion before the fetus attains viability and to obtain it without undue interference from the state.
It said restrictions were legal as long as they weren't proposed with the intention of creating a significant obstacle for women who wanted an abortion. The only rule the court thought was an undue burden was the spousal notification provision. The other restrictions stayed.
The Roe standard was weakened, and it was significantly weakened. And it allowed states to regulate abortion in ways that a pure Roe standard would never have permitted.
Sue Fritchie says new restrictions have made it difficult for all but privileged women to access abortion. The number of abortion restrictions increased dramatically throughout the U.S. since the Casey decision. In Pennsylvania, there are rules about the size of rooms in clinics, and abortions based on the sex of the fetus are illegal. When Casey was decided, there were 81 abortion providers in the state. That number dropped to 42 by 2014, according to the Guttmacher Institute.
Look, I'm all about saving babies.
State Representative Rick Saccone opposes abortion rights. The Republican aligns himself with the late Governor Casey.
You know, he said Roe v. Wade is a law we must observe but never honor.
The Casey decision allowed lawmakers like Saccone to propose new restrictions, like his bill banning abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected. There's been no action on Saccone's bill since he introduced it in May, though similar laws have passed elsewhere. The Supreme Court could use the Casey decision to uphold state restrictions if Kavanaugh is confirmed. Here's Stephanie Dangle at Pitt Law.
The questions at the front of everyone's mind is whether or not Planned Parenthood is going to survive the appointment of a new justice. And time will tell.
But in many states, restrictions born from the Casey decision may effectively end abortion, even if the next Supreme Court justice leaves Roe in place. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
We're going to take significant steps to eliminate drugs. And I will tell you that if these steps are insufficient, we're going to take more steps until we get there.
That's Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Secretary John Wetzel saying that new restrictions implemented this week as part of the lockdown at all state prisons might not be the last ones. We're going to talk about the lockdown in state prisons, as well as the Allegheny County Jail, the cause for the restrictions, and whether they violate inmates' rights with Katie Meyer, WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief in Harrisburg. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
And in studio with us is Alex Morgan Kurtz, staff attorney with the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project. Welcome, Alex.
Hello.
And also in studio, WESA reporter Kathleen Davis. Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Okay, according to the Corrections Department, since May, nearly 50 prison employees have complained of symptoms potentially related to synthetic drugs, and that number has spiked recently. Katie, last week, Corrections Secretary Wetzel ordered all 25 prisons to be locked down. What did that entail? What did that lockdown mean?
So when a prison locks down, a number of things can happen, but the biggest thing is prisoners are confined to their cells almost 24 hours a day. They're allowed to leave for medical emergencies, but pretty much other than that, they stay in there. They get their meals in their cells. They get, you know, non-emergency medical treatment in their cells, and they can't go to any programs. So it's a big deal. It really does change a prisoner's day. They can't go out into the yard. Since then, and also I should say the mail was halted to all prisons, and visits were also halted. So big changes. Since I think the middle of this week, or rather this past weekend, they have relaxed it at some prisons. It's really up to the prisons themselves what they want to do, but some programs have resumed, things like Alcoholics Anonymous, other things, you know, regular showers have been reinstated. A lot of these prisons don't have AC, so that's a big deal. But we are still on lockdown. Mail's still halted. Visits are still halted. So it's, I'd say, a pretty significant step that the DOC has taken here.
And I mentioned synthetic drugs. Is this K2 that they're talking about?
Well, it's a lot of things. So I think we should be really clear about what the situation is with the drugs. Synthetic drugs are powerful, mixtures, essentially, of chemicals that are used essentially like in lieu of opioids in a lot of cases. So K2 is one of them. That's known as a synthetic cannabinoid. But it's not really the same thing as marijuana at all. It acts more like an opioid. And K2 is just like one formulation of these. They come in lots of like really different variations, and it's sometimes really difficult for first responders and for prison guards and other people to tell what drug they're working with. So that's been part of the concern. It's hard to identify this stuff. But yes, it's getting in largely through the mail, sometimes through like prison staff themselves, and you know, a couple other like visits can transfer this stuff. But so a lot of synthetic drugs. Those are the main concern.
Then Kathleen, K2 involved or suspected involved in the county jail lockdown?
So it's still not totally clear what has happened at the county jail. So the Allegheny County Jail went on lockdown on Monday because 11 employees on 3 different floors of the jail suddenly got sick. And they've all returned to work, so they're all okay. But that substance still hasn't been identified. Originally, it was reported as a suspicious substance or odor. You know, with all of this background on a statewide level, it seems like it is a similar situation, but that has not been confirmed yet.
Okay. Last week, Secretary Wetzel used the term indefinite. So is he still saying that, Katie, and any indication when it might be lifted?
It's still indefinite, which is, I should point out, rare. It's rare for any prison in any state to do an indefinite lockdown, much less to all the prisons in its system. They've indicated that they're really hoping to get things quasi back to normal by next week, but that is, you know, very much not a concrete, promise to anybody. They say, you know, if we keep having sickness cases, we're going to continue the lockdown, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Alex, what role does your organization play in keeping an eye on prisoners' rights?
So my organization is a statewide legal aid organization, and we provide legal services to people when they're incarcerated or institutionalized. And so we're involved in litigation about a number of things that happen to people while they're incarcerated. And then we also keep an eye on the systems as issues are happening so that if there's something that we feel is unconstitutional or harming prisoners, we can, if necessary, go into court or at the very least advocate on their behalf by calling the wardens, making contacts with the press, and various other means, and trying to make sure that prisoners' voices are heard and that their issues are not being ignored.
All right. So as I mentioned at the top of our discussion, you're a staff attorney with the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project. Does the state have the authority to impose an indefinite lockdown?
The indefinite nature of the lockdowns, absolutely something that's problematic, especially the longer it goes on. With a number of areas in prisoner rights law, it's always a balancing test. So it's a question of what the institution's needs are at that moment versus the level to which they're infringing on a prisoner's rights, and whether there's a least restrictive or a better way for them to combat that problem. So, you know, a one-day lockdown when a guard is assaulted, is generally a reasonable response. But the longer this lockdown goes on, the longer that inmates don't have regular access to medical care, don't have access to programming, can't talk to their families, can't make meaningful contact with their attorneys, the worse the problem grows.
You said problematic. Is there a tipping point where you get alarmed, concerned, what?
I mean, to be honest, the moment it was announced, my heart sank because I was terrified for a number of both my clients and other prisoners, because the prison system itself is full of a lot of people who have mental health issues. So the imposition of solitary confinement on these people for even 48 hours can cause significant health effects. And I think that if this situation isn't resolved by next week, it's something that personally I, you know, might start thinking about what else we need to do, because it's more than a problem. It's really hurting people, and it's terrifying people. Some of my clients were able to get phone calls out a couple of days ago for the first time, and one of them had a very painful medical condition that it was supposed to be starting to be treated right before the lockdown, and now 10 days later, she still hasn't had any medical treatment because she can't. The practitioners can't get in. She can't get out to it. So she's living with pain every day from medical care.
So the state system has nearly 50,000 prisoners, I understand, from the Department of Corrections. Katie, in your reporting, what has come up about concerns for these inmates, the rights? Has anything been expressed? Have you checked in with people, advocates for the prisoners? What are some of the complaints about the lockdown that you've uncovered?
Yeah, so one of the big things, and I should kind of go into, we didn't get into this, but as the lockdown has been going on this week, the prison system instituted a bunch of new kind of regulatory changes, security changes, and one of those is one of the biggest ones is how they handle mail. So now instead of being sent directly to prisons, mail is going to be processed at a central location, then scanned, then emailed to the prisons. They'll print that out, and the prisoners will get the scanned copy. And the kind of interesting thing is what they're going to do with legal mail. Constitutionally, under the U.S. Constitution, the courts have decided that the best way to handle legal mail is to open it in front of prisoners, let only them see it, and then they can, do what they want with that. But now, since they're not getting any physical copies of mail, what they're going to do is open it on camera so the prisoners can, watch live and see the legal mail being opened. And then a copy of it, as I understand, is going to be kept on file at the prisons if they need to reference it. I talked to the ACLU, and that was one of the big things they brought up, was that if legal mail is being kept on file at the prisons, there's just a larger chance there's going to be some sort of maybe tampering or other issues with that. One of the other things that they brought up, the ACLU, was that they're going to be using ion scanners more broadly to check whether visitors have drugs on them, check whether inmates have drugs after visits. And they said that that's something that, ion scanners have been known to produce false positives. And now, since there are higher consequences for bringing drugs into a prison, if you do it, I think, three times, you can get a lifetime ban from visiting any state prisons.
Right.
That carries a pretty big, significant penalty if there is a false positive. So, these things are not in practice yet. We don't know exactly how they are going to actually work. So these are just initial concerns the ACLU has brought up.
All right, Alex, I want to get your take because you do have legal correspondence with some of your clients. Are you particularly concerned about the mail or the other restrictions that Katie just outlined that were implemented this week or proposed to be implemented this week?
So the DOC's new restrictions are really an exaggerated response to this. And there were three of the main policy changes that are very, very both problematic and I think the easiest to challenge and things that are really concerning. One is the legal mail issue because there's thousands of people in each prison. Prisoners are involved in a lot of legal mail. And if there's the new DOC policy says there's going to be one designated copy.
Of course, DOC, Department of Corrections.
Right. So the DOC said there's going to be one designated copy or used for legal mail. So that means every person's criminal appeals, their habeases, their documents from the court, family law memos, all of this stuff for every prison in a facility has to be copied on this one copier. So I'm really worried about the delay that that's going to put on legal mail getting through. In addition, when it comes to communications between attorneys and clients, I know a number of my clients are going to really be terrified of me and them litigating a case against the DOC and a corrections officer standing there copying every piece of paper of me giving them advice about that. And it will really have a very chilling effect on the First Amendment.
So I mentioned nearly 50,000 prisoners in state institutions. Kathleen, about how many are in the county jail? And this, is a separate issue, but there is a similarity. County, Allegheny County Jail under a lockdown. About how many inmates are we talking about at the Allegheny County Jail?
There's about 2,300 inmates at the county jail right now.
Okay. And you mentioned that the lockdown was imposed Monday after the week, some noticing of illnesses Sunday, was that?
Yes. So between Sunday night and Monday morning, that's when the prison employees started to get sick. And so the lockdown was imposed on Monday. Since then, there's been a partial lift that was announced on Wednesday.
What did this entail, or what is still being restricted that you know of?
Sure. So right now there are 35 pods operating at the county jail. Those are sort of you might be a better person to speak
on this. A housing unit of like 30 or so people, I think.
Sure, sure. And it seems like there's one correctional officer that sort of monitors each pod. So there's 35 operating in total at the jail. 23 have been returned to normal, and there's still 12 that remain locked down.
Okay. We have just about 3 minutes left. I want to get to a few more questions. Alex, is the overall question, when you're convicted, sentenced to prison, you give up your freedom, but what else might you be losing beside that? What is reasonable for the safety of staff, other prisoners?
Well, I mean, prisoners still retain a number of rights, including the First Amendment right to books, which the DOC is now going to be restricting, rights to visits with family and friends, due process rights. And so there is always a reasonableness question, but at the same time, you know, prisoners are people who are in there to be rehabilitated, not further punished. And so these growing restrictions don't necessarily serve any real purpose other than an overreaction to a problem that other states have found other ways to solve.
And Katie, very briefly, to be clear, the reason why the mail and the books, or at least the reasons that the Department of Corrections are giving, is the drugs are somehow, they believe, immersed in or whatever into the mail, the paper, the books themselves?
Yeah, so the concern is that these synthetic drugs can be either sprayed onto or pages can be soaked in them, and that way it can kind of surreptitiously get into the prison.
Okay. So, Kathleen, did the county jail warden, when he lifted part of it, part of the lockdown, did he or any other county officials give any indication when full lifting of the lockdown?
Right now, there's no timeline for when the jail will be completely lifted from this lockdown.
Are they seeing any connection to what's going on in the state prisons, or is it just happenstance?
So Warden Orlando Harper, when he announced this partial lift of the lockdown, said that he believes that he didn't go so far as to say a synthetic cannabinoid, but he did say that he believes the culprit is a narcotic sprayed on paper.
Okay. Just 1 minute left. I want to get to both Katie and Alex. Katie, any hint of how long the lockdown will remain in place at the state level?
You know, there have been sort of quasi estimates from the state that it could be lifted next week. But again, this, you know, is contingent on, you know, if more people start getting sick.
And very briefly, the lockdown might be lifted, but these restrictions, new policies stay in place?
Oh, yeah, these are in place for good. These are permanent policies. So the mail thing is effective immediately, and they're already starting to get that in place. The book restrictions that Alex mentioned, you know, books are all being bought through the department now. That's going to be a permanent thing. All of this stuff is, it's, you know, that's what they're doing.
Right. Final 20 seconds, Alex.
I'd just say that, you know, if there's anyone who has family or friends who's incarcerated in any of these facilities and they've experienced issues during the lockdown or they're concerned about any of this going forward, there's a number of organizations, including mine, the ACLU and the Abolitionist Law Center, that you can reach out to. And we want to hear from you so that we can help your family and friends.
Alex Morgan Kurtz is staff attorney with the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project. Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief in Harrisburg. And we're also joined today by WESA reporter Kathleen Davis. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, U.S. officials say Russian operatives compromised the voting websites or databases of seven states in 2016. As another election nears, we'll visit with David Hickton of the Pitt Institute of Cyber Law, Policy, and Security about the vulnerability of our systems. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.